This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It's been a good week. Just had to yawn there for a minute. It's been a good week. All is well. We're pottering along. Got some things accomplished this week. Looking forward to the weekend. Looking forward to eating. As soon as I get home and get the podcast finished up, we are going to be eating. I had forgotten that I hadn't shut off my Bluetooth there in the car. And once I did that, then the radio hissed. Sorry about that. Apparently, if I look to the east, apparently there's a propane storage place or propane something or other that has caught on fire in Marshfield, which is about 15 minutes by highway east of us. Looks like there's a big black cloud stretched out a little bit, but apparently they got the fire under control, maybe. So I saw a picture of it, and there was a big plume coming up. So anyways, so that's good. Let's see, work is good, all is good. Writing is good. I may be a couple, 100 words down. But I'm good. I had some things to... Or did I finish up last night? Can't remember. I'll find out when I get home. Working on book 15. Book 14 beta readers are turning stuff back in. So that's good. That's all coming in. I've got some things. I don't know where we're going yet in this book, but... You know, step at a time. We'll just keep moving forward, and I'm sure we'll be fine. So that's good. Costumes are good. I'm still working on the Blame It on Someone Else Day stuff. I'm doing some preliminary things. I don't need that until August. But that all seems to be going well so far. Haven't really done that much on it. But, you know, I think everything seems like it's going to be fine for that. So, that's all good. And I look forward in the schedule. And, you know, there'll be a few little tweakings and that kind of things here and there. But about the only... and I mention this because I just... keep getting a ping on this, and I don't know what it means yet. All I know is I'm getting a ping, but it's like the second week in June. Is Magna Carta Day. Not entirely thrilled with Magna Carta Day. I don't know, it just feels like it's like June 15th, I think, and the holiday is, or the Friday is June 11th, maybe. Just doesn't quite feel like the right thing, but I have looked and looked. I don't see anything else. I'm figuring I have a knight's costume, as in Knights of the Round Table, for Magna Carta Day that I wore last year, and people seem to enjoy that, so, you know, so that'll be fine. I may go ahead and get myself a broadsword. I may, since I got the sword for Talk Like Shakespeare Day, and that didn't seem to cause any problems at all, I was concerned last year that it might, so I didn't. Since it didn't seem to cause any problems at all, I may go ahead and order myself a broadsword. So Magna Carta Day, I'm not real thrilled with that yet. So we'll see. But aside from that, everything in the schedule is looking good. I've got around 1st of June, I've got to break out the paper bag day costume and see how much the rats have actually eaten it. gotta see how many mice have built nests in it, because it's just paper and Japanese lanterns and, you know, all that stuff. And I put it in my mechanical room because it is substantial, so I had put up some netting in my mechanical room and just kind of shoved it up into the netting, hoping that the critters wouldn't get to it. But I was in there, it's been several weeks now again, and I looked up and there were some little mouse turds in there. So I imagine they've made themselves a home. So I'm going to have to break that thing out of there in time to do some fixing. So we'll have to see. But anyway, so all is well. Everything's going forward. Our pastor preached a great sermon on Sunday on love. It really was a great sermon on love and on Paul's prayer that we would know the height and depth and breadth, and that we would know God's love. Man, that's something to set as a goal for life, to know God's love. Because everything hinges on that. If you understand God's love for you, you understand that we have a destiny and we have a home that we are going to. That should change everything in our lives. I was having breakfast with a friend. Wasn't last week or the week before. And we were talking about this. Maybe it was this last week. We're talking about this and talking about God's love. And talking about how, in my opinion, all anger, all envy, all strife, all anxiety, all of that is all built on lies. Because if we would understand His love for us, all that stuff disappears. And I know some people say, well, Jesus got angry. Well, yes, Jesus did get angry. There are some of those instances, like the situation in the temple, that people love to point to because Jesus appears to be in chaos. And I'm not sure He was actually in chaos. I think He was doing what was necessary to A, fulfill the prophecies, and B, to set up everything for His death. Because He needed to create a situation where He was a threat. Doing that, in what He did in the temple, He set Himself up as a threat, an economic threat. I'm not certain that using Jesus's behavior in the temple as our template is necessarily a good idea. And there are other places in the Gospels where He is angry as well, but you know, our pastor, my son-in-law, had pointed out that his anger was always coupled with sorrow, that he was deeply sorrowful for what was going on, and that contributed to his anger. But man, that message on love, that was a good one. That was a good one. So, anyways, all is well. This week, this has kind of gotten to be a theme the last couple of weeks here, and maybe it's just because so many people are talking about it that I'm bouncing against it over and over, but it's interesting because this idea of tribalism seems to be very much on a lot of people's minds. You know, this us versus them stuff seems to be very much on a lot of people's minds, and very much on people's minds because they are finding the trending very disturbing. And we've talked about a bunch of things, but I came across this Big Think YouTube video about us versus them. And it was very interesting. They had some people I recognized on there, some people I didn't recognize on there. But, you know, I thought,
excuse me,
brought some pretty good perspectives to this whole thing, and brought some hope, frankly. They were looking for hope, obviously, in this video. And they had some interesting suggestions that showed how there was hope. I, of course, look at those things and plug it into my framework and say, oh, well, that's got to be because this is, you know, because to the man with a hammer, all the world's a nail. But it is interesting that things do fit. So they started out, and the guy who starts out, I'm going to slaughter his last name. His name's Robert Sapolsky, I think. And he's very interesting. He's a behavioral slash evolutionary slash something, something, something. And he, you know, he studies a lot of these things about humanity and why we are the way we are and how we make our decisions and what are the forces that drive us. I'm getting my mail. And a lot of his stuff is very interesting. It's very, very, very interesting. So he was talking about the fact that we are hardwired, just hardwired for us versus them. That we rapidly, rapidly make these decisions of who is us and who is them. That within 20 milliseconds, we're looking across and we're sweeping across and we're making these decisions about us's and them's. And the sad part is, let me see if I can find his lines here. He said, we turn the world into us's and them's, and we don't like them's very much and are often really awful to them. And the us's, we exaggerate how wonderful and how generous and how affiliative and just like our siblings they are to us. We divide the world into us and them. And what's interesting is I hadn't actually... I think maybe I'd heard about this somewhere, but it was really good to go, oh, that's right. And he says, one of the greatest ways of seeing just biologically how real this fault line is in the hormone oxytocin. So oxytocin is officially the coolest, grooviest hormone on earth because what everybody knows is that it enhances mother-infant bonding and it enhances pair bonding in couples. And it makes you more trusting and empathetic and emotionally expressive and better at reading expressions and more charitable. So he said, so it's obvious that if you just spritz the oxytocin up everyone's noses on the planet, it would be a Garden of Eden the next day because oxytocin promotes pro-social behavior until people look more closely. He says, as it turns out, oxytocin does all those wonderful things only for the people you think of as an us. And if you consider them a them, it makes you crappier to them. More preemptively aggressive, less cooperative in an economic game. So even oxytocin enhances us, and it enhances the us and them divide. So that along with other findings, the classic lines of us versus them along the race, of sex, of age, of socioeconomic status, your brain processes these us and them difference on a scale of milliseconds. And to support this oxytocin thing, there was a study that was done in the Netherlands. It was the kind of a classic runaway trolley problem where you have a decision, the trolley is running away, and is it okay for you to sacrifice one person to save five? So is it okay for you to push a guy onto the tracks who gets squashed by the trolley so that it slows down so that five people tied to the tracks, you know, can escape, et cetera, et cetera. Standard philosophy. So what they did is they gave this person that might be pushed onto the tracks, they gave him a name. So either it was a standard name from the Netherlands, Dirk, I think he was, well, he says, I think he was a Peter, which is a meat and potatoes Netherlandish name. Said, or they named someone that was sort of German-ish or someone who was Muslim. So you either were going to save five people by pushing Dirk onto the track or Otto or Mohammed or Mahmoud. They said, in general, if they gave them those names, there was no difference in people how they would rate it if the person was anonymous. But if you give people oxytocin, where they don't know they've just gotten it, control group had a placebo spritzed up their nose, give people oxytocin, and you are far less likely to push Dirk onto the track. But you are far more likely to push Otto and Mahmoud onto the rails. Because oxytocin deepens the divide between us versus them. So that's interesting. Another Alexander Todorov went on and said, look, there are many, many different inputs to impression. So they've got all, we have as humans, all kinds of ways that we divide us into us's and them's. It's not just race. But their research that they did talked about typicality. So what are you used to? So one of the things they did is they took a Japanese face and they took an Israeli face and they morphed between the two of them. And they went back and forth. And he said, if you ask Israeli and Japanese participants to evaluate the faces and see what happens as that face becomes more Israeli, the Israelis believe that the face is becoming more trustworthy. On the other way around for the Japanese. So in a sense, to a large extent, what we perceive as typical is shaped by a natural environment. Okay, so this is really important. Okay, I heard I think it was like a race relation counselor. I think she was a person of color, and then she was working with an African-American lady, and they had done some seminars, and this story that she told in one of her seminars was that they were walking outside at night, and she looked across the street, and she saw a young black man there, and they needed to get some help, but she didn't want to ask him because he was a young black man, and the other lady, who was an African-American, that was no problem. She was going to talk to the young black man. Now, the person of color was all concerned because that made her racist. But if we look at it from a perspective of typicality, and we understand that we have these very important subsystems that are necessary for survival, for us to be able to decide in split seconds who we're going to trust or not trust, who we are going to encounter or not encounter, well, you can point the finger and say, it's racist. Okay, or you can say, well, if your typical experience doesn't include more African-Americans, as the lady of color did not, but the African-American lady did, then you're going to judge that situation differently. Many years ago, my wife and I flew into LA and we were supposed to have dinner with some friends. We had their address. We were going to punch it into Google. We're going to have Google take us. This is LA. So we flew in early enough in the afternoon, thought, well, it'll be fine. Night before, when I'm in Springfield, I pull up the map and it's like, 45 minutes to get there. Great. We've got plenty of time. We get into LA. I pull up the map, hour and a half. Maybe we don't quite have as much time. But so we start up, and pretty soon we hit the traffic. And the traffic is terrible in LA. It's just awful. And pretty soon Google is taking us down off an off-ramp, and we're down, and we're right in the middle of downtown LA. Narrow streets, you know. And I'm looking around, and we were down in some kind of a large congregation of Filipinos. You know, brown faces everywhere, and to my mind, when I looked at them, all I saw was Filipinos. And whereas that might have caused my wife a little more concern, for me, it was like, hey, I'm home. Because that's what I grew up with, typically. Now, what's interesting about all of this is that Sapolsky says, you know, if you just look at it, the fact that we're wired for all this, in his terms, this can be depressing as hell. He says, oh my God, we are hardwired to the inevitable, to be awful to thems and thems of all sorts of disturbing lines. Oh, if we could only overcome these us and them dichotomies. Oh no, why are we hardwired to divide the world along lines of race and ethnicity and nationality and all these disturbing things? And he said, and what becomes clear when you look closely, it is virtually inevitable that we divide the world into us's and them's, and we don't like them's very much, and we don't treat them well, but we are incredibly easily manipulated as to those who count as us and those who count as them. So this is where they're getting their hope from, that we can be manipulated. They said, for instance, you know, you might be convinced that such and such a person, because of their skin color or because of their tattoos or whatever, is a them. And then you might notice they're wearing a baseball cap for the baseball team that you like, and all of a sudden they're an us. So, you know, that is interesting. But what I find interesting about all of this, and this goes on and on, and I've got things to do. I'm actually getting home a little late because we had some special stuff we were trying to get done at the church, so I'm going to wrap this up because I haven't had anything to eat yet, and I'm tired. But what's interesting about this, again, is to put it in the framework of flesh and spirit, is we understand that we have a base subsystem that's valuable. It's valuable. That it helps us recognize threat, that it helps us evaluate whether people are potential threats or not potential threats. That's valuable. But we also need to realize that while that thing is firing off in milliseconds, it's going to take the flesh a little longer to grab a hold of it and pad it with some sort of lie to create a big emotional reaction. And it is within that time that it's padding and giving you that emotional reaction, that's when you have a chance. That's when you have a chance. And if you can take that chance, I absolutely agree with, your brain is malleable enough and your responses are malleable enough that if you take that chance, you can get in the spirit and you can knock that down. So you are not condemned to treat thems cruelly. And one of the ways that you are not condemned to treat thems cruelly is if you understand God's love and understand that we are all his children, because in God's love and the understanding of God's love, all of the thems become us's, because he's working in all of our lives to draw us closer to himself. And there's just some really easy exercises. If, in fact, your responses are going to be based on typicality, then what you need to do is practice making the right things typical. I've told this story multiple times, but it's so important. San Jose, or downtown San Jose, seas of brown faces. Doing my laundry, got my little stuff in my backpack, walk out of the hotels that has bars on the windows. Start walking down the street. This Latino man is walking towards us. He's got his game face on. But I had made a practice of greeting people. Made it typical for me to greet people, especially people of color. He's coming towards me. He's got his game face on. He probably sees me as somewhat of a threat, wondering why I'm down there, and maybe I'm a cop or something. As he gets close, I look up, I look him in the eye, I smile. How are you today, sir? His whole face lights up. Good, you good. Have a great day, sir. You too. If you make a practice of that, that's what becomes typical. And you find that most people will greet you back. They will. Even if you're dressed in crazy outfits. And they're wondering, what in the world? They will greet you back. And then by those exchanges, you begin to change what is typical in your life. You begin to train yourself. One of the other things that I do is that when I look at anyone else, like when I was driving here and coming to here, I saw a man with a lawnmower, and he had the lawnmower in the ditch, and he was working on, you know, trying to get that ditch mowed and twisting the lawnmower around. One of the things that I do, because I'm a writer, I look at people and then I imagine their story. They are not just an object that's in my way or someone I'm going to go past. I imagine their story. I try to pick up on their body posture and their set and the expression of their faces. And I think about what things they might be going through. And I do that not only because I'm a writer and I find it interesting. I do that to establish a connection to them, to be empathetic with their life. Because if I do that and establish a connection with them and realize I could be going through the same things he might be going through, all of a sudden he's not a them anymore, he's an us. So we very much, first of all, even the secular scientists acknowledge that our brain is malleable and we have the capability of moving people from being them to uses by the simplest of triggers. And I would maintain that through our empathy and through our attention to people and through an understanding of God's love, we can, without external inputs, move people from us's, from them's to us's with just a little practice. And that's something we should put into practice every day. We should see every person we encounter as a child of God who is on a path that may be leading them closer to him or away from him. And we should be aware of every potential, of every opportunity for us to help others to be closer to him. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.